Good evening, and thanks for joining us for special election coverage from KHNS Local News. I'm Margaret Friedenauer. On Thursday, October 2nd, we hosted a forum with the candidates for Haines mayor. The candidates answered questions from myself and questions submitted by audience members. This is the entire forum as recorded that evening. Immediately following, we hosted a discussion about the ballot measures in front of Haines voters this year. Our broadcast lasts 1 hour. It's also posted on our KHNS website. Here now is the forum with Haines candidates for mayor, incumbent Stephanie Scott, and challenger and former mayor Jan Hill. So, Jan Hill and Stephanie Scott, do you guys want to start with introductions and why you're running for mayor? And we'll start with Jan.
Thank you. My name is Jan Hill. I think most people know me. I'm a lifelong resident of Haines. And as I was trying to come up with something to start this evening off with, I found myself kind of daydreaming, and I realized that of all the candidates running for anything in the Haines borough, I have I have seen more changes to the Haines borough than anybody in this room. I've lived here 64 plus years, and I've seen good and bad changes, but the bottom line is I've always cared. I care about what goes on here, and I like to be a participant. I like to be involved, and it keeps me moving and happy, and I feel like I contribute when I'm involved. So I'm running for mayor again because I've missed doing the job for the past 3 years, and I think it's time for me to do it again. Thank you.
Thank you, Jan. Stephanie?
My name is Stephanie Scott, and Jan's got me beat on the years here because I've only been here 41 years. And even in that short period of time, there has been a lot of change. In terms of government, our major change was from two strong mayor forms of government to a consolidated government that is a manager form of government. I've had the privilege of being the mayor for the last 3 years. And I think we're building a strong team. I believe that we have a manager that is worthy of the task and will actually introduce us to a true manager form of government for the future. And I'd like to be on that team with him to walk that path.
Thank you, Stephanie. And actually, I'm going to start with you for the first question, okay. And then we'll switch on and off. And this was a question from the audience as well as one I had written down. What is the role of the mayor in deliberations when the assembly is making a decision? And to go along with that, an audience member would like to know, how are you the better candidate to lead meetings of the assembly and with the public? Are you more of a leader or a facilitator?
The role of the mayor is outlined in code. A former mayor told me that when I was elected that the first thing I should do is read code every night, and I do. And the mayor is allowed to participate in discussions. The mayor is allowed to introduce ordinances. My practice is to facilitate discussion among the assembly first and then come in if I possibly can, especially if there's a split, maybe suggest a compromise. I think that the role of the mayor is to build consensus in the assembly. I'm protective of the assembly's time to debate and speak with one another because, in fact, legally at that meeting, a properly convened meeting is the only time that the assembly can legally confront one another, debate one another, wrestle with the issues as a full team. So that's what they do. I am both a leader and a facilitator. If I have it's perfectly permissible for me to add something to the agenda, but if I do, I always cover it with a memo giving my reasons, my rationale, why I think it's an important direction to move. The decision makers in this community are the members of the assembly. The mayor has to break a tie if there's a tie, but that's the only time. The mayor has the right to issue a veto. I've never used that power yet. I've never needed to. So I don't know if that deals with all the elements of the question, but
thank you, Stephanie. Say. Jan, let me know if anybody ever wants me to repeat a question too. You'd like to, yeah, that's what I thought. There were several in there. They were kind of all related is why I read them together. But what is the role of the mayor in deliberations when the assembly is making a decision? Do you think of yourself more as a leader or a facilitator in that realm?
I believe the role of the mayor is to keep the assembly members and the discussions orderly and in timely. And I know that I have a good handle on Robert's Rules of Order, which is a standard way to run a meeting and keep it running so it doesn't get out of hand and drag on. I believe, like Stephanie, that I'm a facilitator and a leader. It depends on the issue. The facilitator part is running the meetings. The role of the mayor is to run meetings and represent the community, work closely with the assembly members and with the manager to make things happen in the Haynesboro. And I believe that my history has proven that I can do that. And I think having an open door and a good communication with the assembly is critical. I think that sometimes if there's a difference of opinion or a difference of philosophy among your elected officials, sometimes things get lost in the shuffle because people don't want to talk to the person that has a difference of opinion. That's sad because that's how we make things, that's how we make compromises happen, is by talking to one another if we don't agree. So I see the role of, one of the roles of the mayor is to facilitate that kind of discussion with the assembly members and the community. I believe that the community input is critical to the assembly members' ability to make a decision that supports what the community wants.
Okay, I'm going to ask a follow-up to that for both of you. You both have served as mayor. So do you have any examples of, you've both dealt with heated meetings, meetings that are packed. You've both dealt with meetings where hardly anybody is there. And you've both dealt with assembly members with strong personalities and views on issues. And so can you think of some specific examples where you have had to step in as a leader in a meeting, in a discussion, something like that, either between the public or between assembly members? And Jan?
Just off the top of my head, I think there have been a couple of times, and I can't be specific because they were a long time ago and they're pretty rare, where I've had to call attention to an assembly member that that their time was up. Robert's Rules actually has actual times that you can follow. But probably the most contentious meetings that I've chaired have been around Heliski issues. And during public hearings, many times it's difficult for people to keep their comments within the allotted time frame, which is generally 2 minutes of public comment. So those are that's probably been the topic that I've had to be the most firm about people staying within the time frame is during a heliskiing public hearing on anything to do with heliskiing.
Okay, thank you, Jan. Stephanie.
Well, we'll not use any names, but I think it was my first meeting, or maybe right at the beginning of my term, when we had a person calling in who was inappropriate, and I didn't even know how to work the teleconference equipment very well, and I did not know what to do, but I knew it had to stop. So I got up out of my chair and went over and unplugged the phone jack, and it was very dramatic, and my heart was racing when I did it. And I never like to ask people to stop talking. It's a very It doesn't feel good, but I do it because I have to do it. And one of the things that we are installing in the assembly chambers is a timer with a light that you can see sitting in the audience, so that, you know, I'm usually looking at a little timer, but you can't see the timer. And so that will help people self-control or self-regulate as well. So I think of the assembly chambers as a container for our discussions, for our public discussions. And I like to look at that container and ask, well, what can we do just with the container to make people more comfortable, to make it easier for people to stay within the rules, to stay civil? So another thing that I've done is I arrive at the assembly meetings early, usually around 6 o'clock. And when people wander in, I try to greet them personally and make them feel comfortable and make them feel like this is, in fact, our living room and a place where we can sit and talk. So I think that those are strategies that I've adopted in order to ease that difficult moment when somebody has to be slowed down or cut off or told that they're speaking inappropriately. And I do often remind people at the beginning of a session that we're going to talk about points, not people. And I think it's okay to add those reminders throughout the meeting. So I using strategies and also just being firm, and even though it's uncomfortable, having to ask people to refrain. One of the things that one time I was asked by APT to moderate a meeting that they were having on Conley Lake, another contentious issue, and I was faced with an audience of 75 people. And there were probably three people in the room who approved of the project. And a crowd mentality began to develop. And people would speak. And when they heard somebody that was speaking with whom they were aligned, they would start to clap. And I had to quickly shut that down and say, please don't do that, because it's intimidating, and you never know who in the room might have an opinion that's different from your own. And a public place is a place for all those opinions to come forth, and intimidation is simply unacceptable.
Okay, thank you, Stephanie. All right, so much like both of your styles, I'm going to adopt that and start a timer, if you don't mind. Thanks for the idea. No offense. So I'll just hold up a little red card if we're hitting like the 2:30 mark, and then if you can kind of wrap it up, that'd be awesome. All right. This is another question from the audience I also had on my sheet. So what is the mayor's role in listening to committees and commissions? And as mayor, how do you support public boards or citizen committees to avoid burnout from too many meetings? And what do you do? How do you help forward the recommendations and the work that committees and commissions do? And I think we started with Jan on the last question. So, Stephanie, please.
Well, the mayor is very much involved in all the different committees and is an ex officio member of every single committee. I should have counted how many committees that we have. And it is, I feel very responsible for those committees, because even though our system allows most of the committees to recommend who they would like to have sitting with them, the mayor has to interview that person that who's recommended in our new system, and then make a recommendation to the assembly, and the assembly appoints. So the mayor sort of vets the different people who are on the committee and then recommends to the assembly, but, you know, has to be articulate about why that person is recommended. So I do have a feeling of, that those committees are under my, supervision, but care. So I attend as many of those committee meetings as I possibly can. And I don't suffer burnout. I guess I like to go to meetings. it's kind of a relief to sit in the committee, in the audience, as and help and often answer questions. And so that's what I do with the committees.
Okay, thank you, Stephanie. Jan?
I've been told that I should have a T-shirt that says meetings are me, mm-hmm. because I also like to go to meetings. And I think the question itself answered or gave part of my answer, and that is listen. That's the role of the mayor in committee meetings and that's how you participate. And of course, the mayor, you know, sitting in the audience, the mayor can be a resource for those committees because sometimes that's the appropriate role at that point. But I think the main thing is to listen, because at those committees, they're the ones that hash out the detail. And they work on, they get public input at their committee meetings, and they get public input on the street. And so I think that the most important thing that the mayor can do is listen to those committees and listen to the public comments at those committee meetings. When I've attended committee meetings, I generally sit at the back. I found that if people aren't looking at the back of the mayor, they might be a little bit more free with their comments and with what they want to share at the committee meeting. And I want people to feel comfortable to speak up when they're attending a meeting. Too many times we have committee meetings and even assembly meetings, and there's nobody in the audience except maybe Tom and the radio station, and that's discouraging. We can't serve the people of this community if we don't know what they want. And your opportunity to tell us, you know, how we can better serve you is to participate. You know, I try to encourage people that don't normally serve on a committee to get involved with one of the committees, whether it's a committee or a board for the library or the museum or Chilkat Center. I think that that's a role for the mayor to take also, is to get new people, get new blood into the picture and new ideas. We can stagnate and be stale if the same people who love to go to meetings are the only ones that do it. So one of the things I like to do is kind of recruit new people to participate in these activities.
Okay, I have a follow-up to that, because especially in the last year or two, there's been a lot of discussion on the Assembly and Planning Commission level about, I don't know what you call it, but you call it, a lot of recommendations have been overturned, that the Planning Commission has made recommendations that the Parks and Rec, not maybe lots on Parks and Rec, but there have been one or two I can think of, Harbor Commission, those kind of commissions. So I guess I'm trying to understand the role that the mayor would play in bringing the commissions and the assembly together on issues to move them forward, rather than having a commission and committee do work that's overturned at the assembly level, or having the assembly do work that could be done at a committee and commission level. If you have any sort of disconnect there, how do you deal with that, I guess? Jan?
I think one way to deal with that is to encourage assembly members to attend some of the committees that they may not serve on, because then they can hear the dialogue and all of the background that goes into the committee members coming up and developing their position and the recommendation to the assembly. Particularly if an issue has been brought forward and the assembly doesn't support what, let's say, the Planning Commission recommends, then perhaps at the next Planning Commission meeting, the assembly members need to be at that meeting so that they can understand the rationale and the reason that that was presented as a recommendation. So that's how I would deal with it.
Thank you, Jen. Stephanie?
Well, there's an assembly liaison assigned to every committee. So, you know, you do look toward that assembly person to represent, to explain what went on. If there is the perception that it is not going to move well at the assembly level, then I think there has to be a willingness on both the assembly and the committee to continue to work on the problem. Even though a committee has a recommendation to the assembly, and they themselves suspect that it won't go well at the assembly level, but they want to try it. And I think that's okay. I think that's worthy. And then if it goes to the assembly and the assembly rejects or modifies the idea, or can perhaps send it back to the committee, and there can be this back and forth time. And I know that's frustrating, but that's how things get worked out. The committees are advisory to the assembly, and so, you know, as things move up, they have to understand that's their role. They are the place where many details can get worked out, but it's always surprising what the assembly will latch on to that hasn't been well vetted at the committee level. And so just because the assembly doesn't adopt it, it can be regarded as time to go back to the committee and keep working on it.
Okay, thanks, Stephanie. I think that means Stephanie starts this next question. We have a lot of questions here from the audience about specific issues. So I'm going to try to, I don't know if there's a way to combine them, but I think a lot of these fall under economic development.
Okay.
And you should know some of the issues that people are very interested in, like stimulating a winter economy, opinion of Constantine Mine, how do you maintain fisheries and tourism priorities, the two industries that make the most money, employ the most people, bring in the most money right now in light of possible mining development and the Juneau Access Road Project, all of these things. So I think under all of this, we're talking about economic development. So how do you see, if you were mayor in the next 3 years, addressing some of these issues that have come up, like the mine, like tourism and fishing all together, the Lynn Canal Road, and what do you think those all mean for economic development in Haines? I know that's a loaded question in a lot of detail, but I'm trying to combine some of these so people can hear your take on some specific issues. Stephanie.
Well, I think we are working right now to stimulate winter tourism. I think that the community has come to a consensus that is a direction people want to go. And I think we're trying to do that in a small way. And metal prices are down. Everybody knows that. So mining is, you know, not really steadfast in Southeast. One of the things that I've always been harbors fishing, that's been something that I see as an anchor for Haines. I mean, our harbors, our PC dock, I think of us as a maritime community, boats, ports, and harbors. And I think it's very important to invest in that infrastructure and, make it even more alluring to others and also make sure that it's working well. So I think that my take on the role of government in economic development is to establish the conditions under which people can engage in commerce. So transportation, ports and harbors are really important to me. As far as the potential lack of harmony that's been discussed between mining and fishing and the impact of mining on our fisheries, I think I think we can look to Southeast Conference for some guidance in this. Southeast Conference just passed a resolution asking the U.S. government to work with Canada on transboundary issues because our rivers run that are rich, feed our fisheries, some of it in lower Southeast, are being impacted by the mining practices in Canada. And that's something that is happening now. And we can look at that and investigate the issue. Everybody knows that I promoted a forum on mining and the impact on mining. Whoops.
I'm going to ask you about that actually after this. So if you can.
Okay.
Is that okay to save that?
Yes, I can save that.
Okay. Jan, the overall, as far as economic development and some of those big issues like mining, fishing, tourism, if they affect each other, that kind of thing, and winter tourism.
I think that anything, any kind of development, especially economic, is intertwined, all of them. They're all a part of the, what makes this community work or not. I've been pleased that we're looking more to developing an economy and things to do and attract people for the winter, but we've had the Alcan 200 snow machine race for a lot of years, and that was a winter activity. It helped our economy, and I think that that was the start. I'm happy to see that we're doing more and more. We have, you know, different skiing things going on. We've got people that are developing cross-country ski trails for people to use. And I think that we're attracting people just because we want things to do also, and we share that with our visitors. The mining prospects, I support mining as long as it's done responsibly. I eat fish out of these rivers and out of the salt water, and I do not want to see that go away. That's a part of our lifestyle. That's part of why some of us live here and why my ancestors anyway probably lived here and made their home here. And I'm glad that they did that so that I could live here. But I keep a close eye on mining. I've watched it for years when Coeur Alaska was first getting involved with the Kensington. I worked for Klukwan Inc., and we were a big part of a consortium to get our local people work. We need economic development has to mean jobs for local people. We all have friends and family that can't live here because there are no jobs. I have nieces and nephews that want to raise their families here, and they can't live here because the work is in Anchorage or the work is in Cordova or some other place, and so that's where they live. We need to find ways to allow our young people to graduate from Haines High School, go away to get college or other training, and come home and be able to live here and support their family. Tourism, we're constantly dealing with tourism. I think it's a good summer economy, and we certainly don't want to have, you know, four or five ships a day, and I will never want to see that, but I think we could handle some more tourism in the summer. A couple more ships a week would certainly be nice. We have to figure a way to provide a balance. Some people don't even like to come to town on Wednesdays now because we have a ship in. Well, go to Skagway on a four-ship day.
Do you want to follow up? Go ahead.
And I think that ultimately our fishing economy, our fishermen are a huge contributor to our economy. I grew up in a fishing family. My husband was a commercial fisherman. And I think that we are doing them a disservice. The fact that our fishermen store their boats in Skagway is just absolutely unacceptable. We need to accommodate what our fishing fleet needs so that they can keep their boats here and do their haul out work here. And I know that some of that's being developed now, but we need to promote that. A good balance between all these different economy or economic development ideas is the only way any of this is going to work. We can't rely on one of these factors to make our community better. We have to have a balance of all of them.
Okay, thank you, Jan. And a follow-up to kind of what Stephanie was alluding to, I was going to try to follow up with that, is she did mention that, I mean, Constantine Metal Resources at the Palmer Project is in the exploration stage right now. But there is a lot of discussion in the community about where this is going and what that means for the community. And there was discussion about trying to open community forums or dialogue, and does the community, should this be a bigger discussion in the community, and should that discussion be led, I think this is the question, should that discussion be led by the borough in some fashion. And Jan, do you want to, how in the next 3 years do you think if you were mayor that's something that needs to happen, and how would you make that happen if you think it is?
Yes, I think all of that needs to happen. I think that it needs, we need to have transparency. People need to understand the real impacts, whether they're good or bad, of mining. And I think that right now there is very little information out there, and that makes people, that scares people, the feeling that there might be something hidden. I think public meetings, public forums, that allow both sides of the issues to be expressed and developed and discussed among the community is the only way that we're ever going to make any of this work. So I think that opening it up to the public is the only way to go, and I would certainly want to help facilitate that.
As mayor, you would be willing to facilitate some of those meetings and
yes,
discussions?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Stephanie, would you like to take this? I know that
sure.
You have experience.
We've been working on it. Assemblymember Schnabel and I brought a plan to the assembly. It wasn't, we were authorized to continue to work for together with the Chilkat Indian Village and the Chilkoot Indian Association. And what we'd like to do is to have those three governments, the Chilkoot Indian Association and the Chilkat Indian Village and the Haines Borough, sponsor a series of meetings. And what we would do is bring in people to testify about mining and explain, and so that we could all listen together. And the trick is to find people who can come to us as experts, but without a particular agenda. People that we can trust, that we can have confidence in, that we can all have confidence in what we're hearing. And I think that's going to happen. And whether I'm mayor or Jan's mayor, I think that's absolutely going to happen.
Okay, thank you, Stephanie. Okay, we're getting up on our 45 minutes, if you can believe it. So I think I have two or three more questions. It might take us just over 45, but I think they're all, this is kind of a different question for each of you, but you can kind of answer it how you want to, but I kind of have it's a specific question for each of you as a sitting mayor and as a former mayor, okay? Stephanie, you've served in the last 3 years. Name a couple of initiatives you personally have accomplished in those 3 years. And I'll just to let you know what Jan's question will be then is, what in the last 3 years would you have done differently? If you can think of something, the specifics on this, okay? Stephanie.
Okay. Well, you know, everybody knows that before I was mayor, I was the energy sustainability coordinator. And so my love is energy and controlling the costs of energy. And I'm very proud to have participated in the bringing to Haines of the biomass pellet boilers that are, you know, we now have one installed in the senior center. The Chilkoot Indian Association followed suit with an installation in their building. There's an installation in Old Roods. There are installations going into the private sector around town, and that is exactly what we hope to demonstrate. We wanted to show with in a public setting an installation that was could be comparable to installation in other commercial or private venues. And so we did. And we have maintenance records. We've tested it. I'm really proud of that particular initiative. And as a consequence, we have a $1.2 million grant from the Alaska Energy Energy Authority to continue to install pellet boilers in municipal buildings. And the purpose is that we want to conserve our energy we don't want to use electricity for heat because we have a limited amount of hydroelectricity available to us, and we want to not encourage people to use it for heat. So that is one of the things that I've been very proud to initiate. Another thing has to do with the way assembly meetings are recorded. We have gone to a kind of a minute situation where they're called action minutes, and we have finally got our recording system set up so that what you're going to be able to do is you're going to be able to look at these minutes, and you're going to be able to press an icon, and you're going to be able to hear the discussion around each issue. And I think that's a great use of technology and helping people stay informed and hearing what really went on. Okay.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Stephanie. Jan, can you think of some things in the last 3 years you may have taken a different approach to?
I can, but I'm not going to speak to those right now.
Oh,
I just think that I can't argue with either of the things that Stephanie just pointed out, because I would have supported this very same thing. I'm very happy to hear about the new use of technology, and I certainly am energy conscious as anyone, because those bills get pretty high. So I think those are all wonderful. I think I wanted to just refer to something that happened when I was the mayor, and that was the formation of the Heliski Committee that had a cross-section of community members, so that we felt when we developed that committee that the stakeholders, the community, was well represented with that committee. We actually, you know, it was not an easy thing. Those meetings were long and hard, and they were difficult, and people were angry, and some people were happy. But we came to compromises. I think that one of the things that has guided me through my tenure as an elected official is looking for that compromise. I think balance is critical. Balance is critical in our native culture here, and it's something that was instilled in me, and I will always look for balance. You're never going to make everybody happy. It just isn't going to happen. It's a rare thing, and in our community things can get pretty contentious. I think that we need to continue to look for that balance, and that's what I would do. I think I brought that to the Haynesboro when I was the mayor, and I would continue to do that.
Okay, thank you, Jan. So I'm going to end on this question. There are several other questions that we didn't get to from the audience. Several people interested in solid waste. Several people still interested in mining and economic development and the police force and some other things. But I'm going to end on this because I think it kind of goes back to the last question. So you have an audience here. You're going to have an audience that might listen to this. If people are still undecided after listening to your questions now, after reading your answers in the paper that I believe today you have the grid that asks the candidates all the questions. If people are still undecided, how are they supposed to decide? How are they supposed to distinguish between the two candidates for mayor? If they're still sitting here listening to the questions, many of them are similar. You pointed out a few differences, but how are they supposed to distinguish between the two of you? Jan, do you want to start?
Certainly. Come and talk to me. My door is always open. I'm actually more convenient now. My shop has moved uptown. I'm an uptown girl now. My phone number is listed. I'll give you my cell phone number. I've had numerous people coming and talking to me. As you all know, you can't go to the post office or the bank or the grocery store without somebody wanting to talk to you about something. And I welcome that. I welcome it. I wouldn't be able to do the job if you didn't talk to me and tell me what you want or what you don't want. Either way, that helps me decide how we're going to try to come to some kind of compromise or a balance or a decision. So that's the best thing I can tell you. Read what's in the paper today. I just picked it up. I have no idea what they pulled out of what I said when I answered those questions, but I know what I said. So if you read something in the paper that you go, really? Did she say that? Come and ask me. And that hopefully that will help you decide who you want to vote for. My door is always open. And yesterday I had Judith at the hair shop come in and say, are you going to sell beads today or are you just going to sit here and talk politics? Well, I can do whichever I want. When it's my shop, I'm the boss. So come and talk to me. Don't just assume that something you've read or heard on the street is true, or my position on something is what you heard on the street. Come and talk to me. I'm pretty approachable, and I love to talk to people. So come and see me, and I hope that that will help you make a decision.
Okay, thank you, Jen. Stephanie?
Well, you know, you can come and talk to me, too. I mean, but also you can... one of the things that I do and have done as mayor is walk around. I go and see you. So I like to come to where you are. I believe that that is really an important thing for an elected official to do, is to be present in the community where the community is gathered, not always expect the community to come to them. So that I don't know that that's a difference between us. When Jan and I walked in here together and we said, you know, what we're going to do is we're going to demonstrate to the audience how we want the community to be. We wanted the community to be together and cordial and civil and happy to see each other. And so there's not a lot of difference between us. But it's just, it's going to be up to you. When I was thinking about filing to run again, my friend from the Fairbanks North Star Borough, Luke Hopkins, I was worrying about it, and I was up in Valdez, and we were stuck there, and so we had a six-hour drive to Anchorage, and he said, Stephanie, stop worrying. It is the people who will decide, not you, and so it's up to you, and please vote. Last year, we had a 45% voter turnout. I'd like to see that broken this year, and, you know, at least more than 50%. How about 100%? So, you know, go out and vote.
Okay, thank you, Stephanie. All right, Jan Hill and Stephanie Scott, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was our forum with Haines candidates for mayor, Stephanie Scott and Jan Hill. Following that forum, we continued with a discussion of the ballot measures in front of Haines voters this year. Here is an edited version of that discussion with Assemblymember Deborah Schnabel and Haines School Board President Anne-Marie Palmieri.
And there's going to be, I guess, a total of four questions. Three of them are about school bonds, and we'll get to that subject in a moment. But we're going to go over what I thought would be the easiest question to go over first. It's going to be ballot question one, I believe. And it's the 40% rule. And I have an explanation here, but I think, Deborah, since you've worked on this in the last 3 years, I just want to tell the audience, I wasn't up here to do the debate. I don't have someone on like each side of it. We're just trying to provide some information. And if you have questions, I thought this was a good way to air them. I do have some questions from, I've heard a few critics of each ballot measure that I'll bring up with the people I have presenting. But the people I have presenting basically have the most knowledge I could find about the issues. So, Deborah, do you want to talk about the 40% rule and what this question strives to do?
The question that's on the ballot pertaining to the 40% rule is a follow-up to a more impactful issue that was addressed in a previous election, and that is that we switched from designing a ballot where people would contest another person to simply being a candidate for an office, meaning we were having a slate. Now, we had in the, and we have right now, in both in code and in our charter, the assumption that we would have candidates vying against each other one-to-one.
So for different seats.
For different seats.
Right.
And it was required then that in order to win, a person had to have 40% of the, at least 40% of the votes for that seat in order to win. When you have a slate of candidates, like we are facing in this election, for example.
Basically meaning the top two vote-getters will get the two.
Right, the slate is five people vying for two seats. So everyone is at the polls should vote for two candidates. So everyone's votes are going to be spread through those five people. Getting or requiring a candidate to have 40% of the vote will be a very difficult thing to do because they're going to be spread through a greater number of people. So the idea or the concept that whoever has the most votes wins is what's operative in a more functional way when you have a roster. And we did not invent this. I think it needs to be acknowledged that other communities that have the roster method or the slate method of balloting have the stated rule that the most votes wins. Most votes wins. So whoever gets the most number of votes gets seated, and then who has the next most number of votes gets seated if there's two. If we're vying for three seats, it goes on down the line. So we need to do that. I consider it housekeeping, actually, to dispense with the requirement that a candidate receive 40% of the vote. And hopefully we will do that this election, and then hence from now on, all of our elections will be won by those people who get the most votes.
Okay. I have a couple questions. If this passes.
After this.
Yeah, it won't be in effect for this election. So the state has the 40% voter requirement. Some other communities have the 40% voter requirement. And one of the criticisms of this question is that you could potentially put a candidate into office that has very low voter confidence, even though they may have the highest number of votes.
Gosh. I would hope that people care enough about that to go to the polls and vote.
Okay. The other, I think, question may be, how are you calculating the number of votes? How are you calculating the 40%? It's by the number of people that vote, right? Not a percentage of registered voters or anything of that. It's the number of people that show up to vote.
I believe that's correct.
Okay.
The number of votes cast. And in the system that we are now adopting, well, no, we wouldn't have that anymore, I guess. The number of votes cast divided by the number of seats to be filled is the 40%.
What if I go to the polls Tuesday and I like one candidate a whole lot and I don't like the other four and I don't want to see any of the other four get on the assembly? And so I'm going to vote for one even though there's two seats open. Why is that something that you don't think should occur?
Well, I think because it should not... I'm not going to use the word should. If a person goes to vote and chooses to not vote to fill two seats, you have to remember that the second seat could be filled by somebody who has a very few number of votes. So it's always in a voter's best interest to vote for the two candidates that they think would do the best job. If you vote only for one, you're giving up your right to impact who is elected because there will be two. And if everybody goes to the polls and only votes for one, then let's presume one person gets 80% of the vote and all the other votes are spread between the other four people equally. You're going to see somebody voted, as you've already stated, voted in with maybe 50, 60 votes. So I think that it's incumbent upon us as elected, the electorate, to elect two people to office and do your best to choose the two people that you think would be best.
What happens if it fails?
My understanding would be that if this fails, then we are held to a 40% rule, which means that every candidate who is seated has to have received 40% of the vote, which means that in cases like we have now, where we have five candidates, which is a lot, really, for three offices, for two offices, the chances of having to have a runoff are probably greater because the number of votes is being spread more thinly.
Thanks, Deborah.
All right, thank you.
I appreciate your help. I invited Anne-Marie Palmieri, the school board president, to talk about the bonds, the three bonds on the ballot. These are all school projects. However, they are borough bonds, meaning the borough is in charge of major maintenance for the school district, and these are considered major maintenance. And they are school projects. They are very well described on the Haines School District website and in the newspaper. And Anne-Marie, would you like to discuss why the school board, can I ask you this question, why you believe the school board believes these are necessary projects?
So there are three different projects, and I guess I'd answer your question just by describing a little bit about the projects. So I would like to caveat this first by saying these are major maintenance projects, and I asked Carlos Jimenez, who's the borough facilities director, to come tonight, but he was unable to come. So I don't have intimate knowledge with like the roof, but I can tell you what I know. So there might be some questions that you have that I can't answer. So
technical.
Yeah. Yes, technical. Okay. Questions.
Understood.
So first project is ballot measure two is the vocational education building, and that is a project to do some upgrades to the building, demolition architectural work, safety upgrades, fire suppression sprinkler, fire alarms, improvements to the fuel system, the small engine parts cleaning tank, toilet, welding station, vehicle exhaust, the renovation of the heating plant, new building automation system for the mechanical, and then there's an oil-water separator that right now discharges to the sewer system, which we don't want to do.
And that's about $1.7 million.
It is. And, okay. And Department of Education has approved that for a 70%
reimbursement. Okay. And Proposition 3 is the air handling units, and this one is a bit unique. It's $412,000, but the work has already been done and mostly paid for, correct?
That is correct. And these were air handling units that are in the current art room that were installed back in 1970 when the building was built. We were hoping to change them out during the building renovation in 2007-2008, but during that construction, we were kind of running out of money at the end of the project, as construction projects do, and so that was something that kind of fell off the list. So the borough and the school district actually jointly paid for those air handling units to be replaced. That work happened this summer. And the reason we did that was because it was they were very noisy, and it was really affecting how the kids could hear in the art class. And so we said this is a priority for us, and we want to make sure that it happens. The borough and the school district, it was a joint priority, and so we made it happen. And now what we are hoping to do is go out to bond so that then the state will come in and do the debt retirement and also pay for 70% of that.
That is a bit confusing because it asks voters if they want to issue the $412,000 bond even though the project has already been paid for. So, but the issuing the bond would allow the borough to get the 70% reimbursement if we get down to basics on this one, right?
Yes, that's what I understand.
Okay. And Proposition 4 is the $1.8 million for the Haines High School roof replacement.
Right. So what I understand about the roof, I've done some research, read the roof report. So there are portions of the roof that were that are original. There are portions of the roof that were constructed in 1999, which would, you know, also be 15 years old. And then there are leaks and splits in the seam. As you can see in the roofing tiles here, just in the open area, the stains where water has dripped in this part of the building. And there have been leaks pretty much throughout the building over the years. Maintenance workers throughout the years, as well as Carlos, they've kind of tried to have a real meeting of the minds about the roof. And so the question came up in that we could continue patching the roof and trying to fix the problems and chase the problems, or we could replace the roof. And so during the joint borough assembly school board meeting last spring, a decision was made that, you know, we would like to just go ahead and replace the roof due to the fact that, you know, there are these portions that are 45 years old and nearing the end of its serviceable lifespan. And so let's get a roof that will protect our investment and keep our kids safe.
Okay. So just to go over a few other details, what doesn't appear on the ballot is kind of what the effects of a bond are, but the borough does have information. Basically, you get to vote on each one, on each project, yes or no, whether it should be approved. All three total $3.9 million, just over $3.9 million. If the borough chooses to repay those bonds through property tax, that would come out to about 0.3 mils, which equals, assuming a 20-year repayment and a 4.2 interest rate, that represents $30 per year on taxes on a $100,000 home. So that's what you could, if all three bonds pass, that's what you could expect to see as far as how to repay them on a property tax bill. However, this has come up in an assembly meeting. The borough doesn't make the decision on how to do those repayments until the next budget cycle. If they go the traditional route of doing this through property taxes to make the annual debt payments, it would be 0.3 mils if all three pass. And that is taking into account the 70% reimbursement. It would be much larger, of course, if the state wasn't giving the 70% reimbursement on all three projects. Let me ask you one more question. What happens if these don't pass?
So these projects have been on the CIP list for years through you know, the state CIP list, and they just haven't moved forward on that list due to pretty much the allowable state funding. The projects have moved up in priority, but the amount of state funding that's been allocated has been reduced. So there are fewer projects that are funded. So even though ours are moving up in priority, they just haven't made the cut. So I think at that point we would either just, you know, put them back on the list and hope for the best, you know, but eventually, you know, the roof will need to be replaced. And then, you know, that would be a way to fund that would be something we'd have to figure out with the borough assembly.
That was our hosted discussion of the ballot measures in front of Haines voters this year, as recorded Thursday, October 2nd. Don't forget, you can find all our election coverage, including these recorded forums and interviews with Skagway Assembly candidates, on our KHNS website. For KHNS News, I'm Margaret Friednauer. Don't forget, local municipal election day is Tuesday, October 7th. Thanks for joining us this evening for special election coverage from KHNS Local News, and thanks for your support.